and welcome to the Cosmetic Courses podcast. Adrian Richards and Ron Myers continue their discussion now about the recent FACE Conference 2012.
I mean, it is often confusing. So I was at the meeting and, you know, I went to a couple of talks on radiofrequency treatments, and, you know, some practitioners who I really respect said they've introduced them to their clinic and they're doing well for skin tightening on the face and also for areas like the tummy, you know, after pregnancy.
Yes.
I mean, they're expensive. I mean, the difficult decision is, you know, when to incorporate them in your business, isn't it?
Well, I mean, they are. I mean, I think prices have come down and are coming down, but, you know, you're looking at still something in the order of 30,000-35,000. That's, I don't think, when you're looking at the professional marketplace, and I would say the kind of the quality manufacturers, you know, to come down beyond below that seems to be difficult as a, from a business model perspective for them. But I mean, we've got two of those types of devices, and I think as long as you sell them appropriately and people understand the degree of improvement that they're likely to get, and again with these, it's not marked, it's not like a facelift. And in fact, some of the studies that have been done, the objective studies that have been done by companies like Candela Cinnamon, I know have sort of, with their, I think it's their E-Prime system, has shown that it's about a third as effective as a facelift.
Yeah.
So, you know, it kind of gives you the degree of improvement you're going to get. I think the problem is what we don't really know is exactly how long that lasts for any individual. And, you know, I guess with a facelift, people are looking at what, depending on, I guess, what type of facelift they've had, between 5 and 10 years.
Yeah, I normally say you'll look 8 years younger, you know, like a version of you 8 years ago. And in fact, quite often when I'm telling patients that, I think, well, you know, 8 years is that very much. But if you think, if I could give you a magic potion, Ron, which made you look like you did 8 years ago, would you go for it?
Oh, of course. And, you know, the market is there without a shadow of a doubt. But I think if you look at the number, I mean, it's certainly the interesting thing as well, when you're looking at facial surgery, even though when you're looking at, you know, all of the injectable treatments and where this market has gone over the last few years, and there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that have been brought into that more medical part of the market in terms of looking at, as you say, trying to hold back time and look better, as opposed to just putting a cream on their face, which of course the majority of women would have done 10 years ago anyway.
Yeah.
But taking that next step onto a facelift, you know, there's still a relatively small number of people that really do that, and it's still, when you're looking at the number of facelifts that are done compared to certainly like liposuction and breast implants, it's very small.
I think it's more in America though, isn't it?
It's still an area that is, you know, when you look at the stats, facelifts are still well below, you know, the body contouring procedures, which is kind of interesting. I don't know why that is, whether people still feel it's because it's a more kind of, you know, it's a more dramatic visual change that, you know, could have, and because it's their face, I don't know whether that's, you know, where, versus a contour, where they know that obviously they're going to be potentially ill and scarring or whatever, but where they're, the contour deficit that they got there is obviously something that really concerns them, and they want to improve that contour through breast augmentation or decrease it through liposuction. You know, it's I don't know. It is interesting, and I don't know whether you've seen, you know, with the rise of injectables over the last 10 years, more and more people going on to then have a facelift.
I think this is interesting because I think most patients don't want to look different. My friend Brent Tanner, who trained me in plastic surgery and cosmetic surgery anyway, and he tells me a story when they used to do very aggressive facelifts or deep plane facelifts. And he had a lady who he treated, and she had done the flowers in the church for 20 years and knew the vicar very well. She had the facelift. She went back to the church and was doing the flowers, and the vicar came along and put out his hand and said, "Hello, welcome to the parish." So he basically didn't recognise someone he'd known for 20 years. Now, people don't want that. Most of the patients I see, they want to look like younger, fresher versions of themselves. Now, Ron, so just moving back, this is so what percentage of people do you think would like, if they could just click their fingers, would like to look better, younger, fresher versions of themselves?
I'm sure the vast majority, really. I think there's very few people that, especially in our culture as well, which is, you know, very, very much dominated by beauty and youth, you know, who wouldn't want to, when they get to a certain age, and I think this is it depends on what age you ask them, really.
Yeah.
Same with my wife, actually. I mean, when I've been involved in the markets, you know, since sort of 94 with the launch of the Botox. And, you know, my wife said all those years ago, she could never, ever have anything like that, ever. Mm. Once you hit 40, yeah. you start to see these little tram lines get deeper and deeper between the forehead, you know. Mm. She suddenly, you know, and she's been having treatment for the last sort of 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And so people's minds do change, and I think it does depend on when you ask them.
Yes.
And I think as more and more people, and just ordinary people, are having these treatments and tell their friends about them, and, you know, if they see that visible improvement there, then you can see how it is encouraged. But paradoxically, the other part of the market, of course, as well, is looking at the dangers that are always, you know, expressed and put forward there in the press, you know, about botched jobs and, you know, people, especially with fillers, having problems. And so I think there is still that, you know, element there that does pull people back. And this is why, actually, very interestingly as well, there was also another lecture. This is Myosciences have basically come up with a cryo unit that actually destroys the nerve, which will cause an immediate block in the forehead. And so this is a new technique that I think will come to market possibly by the end of this year, that is basically, they feel from their market research that there is a niche for this product for people who are averse to toxin,
yeah,
and don't want toxins for modulation of sort of frown lines. For me, though, I would be more concerned about having something that would cause that immediate trauma to a nerve, where you get an immediate block, and in fact, it is immediate when you see it on the videos that they show as well. And where that nerve, you're really depending on that regeneration of that part of the nerve in order for them to get that movement back. But you've got no movement at all.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what you think of that as well, and looking at where we've gone over the years from sort of having this, you know, like total kind of block anyway with toxins to more of a natural look.
Well, I think we are going more natural. I think it's ironic in a way. I mean, if I go to dinner parties, people say, "Oh, I'd never have Botox. It's a poison. It's a toxin. It's a this." I mean, botulinum toxin is about the safest drug you can get.
Totally agree.
I mean, it's totally safe. It's totally effective. It doesn't matter if you inject it intravascularly. No one, as far as I know, has ever had a serious adverse reaction to it. It's effective. So it's the perfect drug. Now, so people don't like the toxin side of it. Simple drugs like paracetamol and aspirin cause much more trouble than botulinum toxin. So it's misunderstood, I think, Ron.
Well, I agree with you as well, and I'm not convinced about the need for having a different way of being able to achieve that through basically killing off part of a nerve.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I know it is being trialled, that's for sure. And I think it probably will be launched to surgeons for a start, because I think there is an element of really knowing and understanding in the anatomy and getting this, you know, in the right place. But I'm not entirely sure what sort of uptake it's going to have.
I think from, you know, our experience with Leslie Ash and all those sort of problems, I mean, permanent fillers cause permanent problems. And, yeah, we always encourage people at cosmetic courses to stay safe. A lot of these, I mean, we've all seen permanent fillers that are a nightmare to get out. So as far as I know, you could probably clear up this. I mean, not many people have been involved in litigation from patients in the UK for botulinum toxin treatment.
No, I mean, when you talk to the insurers and the underwriters through this as well, the problems occur far more with fillers than they do with toxins. Which is why I think, again, you know, there is this move to look at, you know, the whole classification of fillers and whether or not, especially taking into account the fact that there is this issue of looking at the quality of the filler and the amount of regulation it goes through, but also it's looking at who can gain access to that without a prescription as well, which it would seem anyone.
Yeah.
And in fact, funnily enough, I was talking to Marketform, who are the biggest underwriter in our business, really, yesterday. I had a meeting with Hamilton Fraser, really just looking at the whole podiatrist issue. And they said that they were offered a book for basically a whole cohort of around 150 beauty therapists that somebody had wanted to pull together and underwrite them for fillers.
Right.
That's a lot. And Marketform said they wouldn't do it, but they basically, you know, went round and they found another underwriter to do it.
Yeah.
And again, I think you know, there are clearly, from an insurance point of view, there are underwriters that I think don't understand some of the views and semantics within this business, because they don't have access to or the understanding of really some of the issues involved with these products and some of the arguments that are being raised out there by people who've been involved in the industry for many years. Yeah. And they just see it as a business and as a kind of like a risk exercise, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is a business that they're in, but they don't really look at the ethics and some of the underlying things behind it.
No. Could you tell me this, Ron? I was asked this earlier on, actually, as teaching in the course. They said, so Juvederm is not a prescription-only medicine.
No, even though it contains lidocaine.
Which is?
Yeah.
So that's interesting, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I think, you know, I've asked that question before as well, and I think it just relates to, for some reason or other, the percentage of lignocaine that's in there. But for me, it seems a total anomaly, really. Yeah. And you know, I honestly don't really understand it. And, you know, I think trying to get answers from the MHRA or even the companies about this, because I think the companies kind of sit on the fence with this as well, because clearly having to, if it was a prescription medicine, then they'd have to go through an awful lot more R&D and research and costs involved in order to get that product to the market.
Yeah.
But I think they also, some of the companies realise and understand as well the problems associated with having a non-prescription product and who is getting hold of this practically in the UK at the moment.
Yeah.
And utilising it in different business models. And, you know, it does seem to be, you know, a particular problem with the UK rather than other countries in Europe.
Yeah. I totally agree. Yeah. We are very under-regulated in the whole industry, really, aren't we?
Well, we are. And so whether or not there will be a rebound and, you know, over-regulation at some point in the future, because, you know, I can only see problems, more problems coming forward, really. Or whether we'll just kind of, you know, whether this will just go on and get, and it is, it's getting murkier and murkier. And some of the people I speak to now as well, it is quite interesting. They're kind of saying, you know what, it doesn't feel as though it's the right sort of thing for me to be involved in anymore.
Yeah, really?
Which is quite interesting as well. Yeah, but I think because people see this, it's kind of like, you know, it's all kind of going down and down and down in terms of like looking at, I guess, the sort of standards, who's involved and whatever. And I think they feel if you've got some colleagues that are involved, for instance, and we've seen this as well, you know, professional beauty, there's the medics who are involved in basically selling these off stands, and, you know, it's almost cheapens it, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then if you've got every speciality, it seems like under the sun, that seems to be able to getting hold of these treatments now, you know. So, you know, I saw the other day, literally in rugby, a podiatrist, and they had a big sign up outside, you know, Botox and dermal fillers now available.
Mm.
You know, whether or not they kind of feel, well, look, you know, is this the sort of, you know, area that I want to be involved in?
Mm.
And I think it is interesting. These are some of the people who've been involved in it a long while. It's more of a kind of a feeling. They're sort of, you know, and prices are going down and down and down, of course, as well, which has been another issue.
Yeah.
And it is being driven by other specialties coming in. They go on a £450 training course, get a hold of the toxins and fillers, and they look and go, how do I do this? I'll compete on price.
Yeah.
You know, Groupon deals as well. None of this really adds to the area of kind of professional medical treatment, does it? Professional medical high class, which is, I think, where most people kind of want to be involved in. You know, they want to be involved in something that's professional medical. And I think some people, when they're looking at this, and especially their peers who aren't involved in this, you know, look at it and kind of go, well, all this is a bit messy now.
I totally agree. You wonder where we're going, really, with it all. But
you do, and it does lend an argument to that as well. There's, you know, well, how professional is this? And I think a lot of people, I'm sure yourself and we have as well, you know, the point with FACE conference and everything as well, was to try and say this is a serious medical specialty where there is a need here, but where training is key. Where there aren't regulations, and where the person doing it and their skill and competency related to the whole environment that's in there and how you promote this as well is really important in order to maintain this as a credible specialty and to treat people properly. You know, and I think we've just slid away from that.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now, Ron, I can't let you go away without asking about the bull.
Oh, yes.
Which, unfortunately, I was not able to attend. But I was thinking about you late at night. So talk me through that.
That was great. I mean, we've had it there before, and it's without doubt my favourite venue. So we took over the whole of Madame Tussauds, and I don't know whether you've been there before or not, but there is an experience that you go through before.
Yeah.
So you go on this sort of little tram and go through basically London through the ages. And then they had this 4D experience in a planetarium, which is which is fun as well. And then we went in, and basically all the tables were laid out amongst all of the wax models.
Yeah.
And there was a 350 people there, I think, because it was the 10th anniversary. We also had a cake on each table that everyone had to decorate as a little kind of thing, and we sort of looked at who made the best decoration. And then there was obviously the obligatory band and disco as well, which went on till about 1:30 in the morning. So there are a few people we saw heads the next day, but it is part and parcel of it, I think. If you're going to come along to a medical conference, then people also like to have that, a night where they can relax, let their hair down and have a bit of fun as well.
Yeah, and it was sold out. Now, Ron, honestly, what time did you go to bed?
It was about 2:30 that morning, so it wasn't too bad actually, because I've got to be up there before everyone else, unfortunately, trying to pull people together, and sometimes it is a little difficult trying to get especially some tired doctors there on time.
Yeah.
Compass mentis, especially as the first session on the Sunday as well, tends to revolve around practical injection sessions, and so you've got to get it all sorted, so
might be a little bit shaky.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
It was fun.
Yeah, that was great, and it was sold out. It looked like I saw some pictures. It looked like a lovely event. Now tell me about the forthcoming body conference.
Yes, I mean that's in November, 3rd and 4th, and so really this is the fourth one, and really what we do is look at everything that we don't look at face. So we're looking at, in fact, a 2-day meeting this year. We're hoping on surgical related options. And I know you're going to be involved in that as well. Really looking at your experience with PIP.
Yeah.
We're going to have a day we think focused more on breasts, and another day focused more on really, I think, the other issues related to body contouring. So probably more really liposuction. And we'll be looking at non-surgical options. So we'll be looking at all the different devices that are promoted out there, whether it's cryolipolysis, whether it's LED systems, ultrasound, RF, or even combinations of different versions of technologies for non-surgical body contouring. We'll look at other areas like hair removal, laser hair removal, which is obviously a very, very big part of the market.
Mm, yeah.
And something that we don't really cover at face. We'll look at tattoo removal. We'll look at treatment of stretch marks, scars, and all sorts of other areas as well that do fit into, even looking at weight management as part of a business model, because I think that does potentially go hand in hand with looking at liposuction or non-surgical body contouring, because undoubtedly I think, unless you can manage that aspect of nutrition and potentially exercise appropriately, and that's a very big ask, of course, as well. For us, we don't believe that even liposuction, is a treatment for obesity, even though, unfortunately, I think some clinics do sell it as that. But we think it's a body contouring treatment rather than a weight management treatment. And I think clearly there are some people we have come into our clinic as well who are well over the BMI that we would accept before we treat them. And so having, I think, something there rather than just go away and lose weight, but something in there that is a program that they can maybe go through that can help them get better control over their weight before then you tackle that body contouring issue, wherever it is, potentially is an appealing part and does fit into a business model.